Once more unto the breach, dear friends.
Else fill the wall up with our English dead.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and welcome to another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jake and...
Jeff
McClure. So this is The Personal Wealth Coach. This is Jake McClure speaking to you. On the line with me, I have Elder Baldy, as opposed to Younger Baldy, who is Jeff McClure. We are the Personal Wealth Coach.
That's me.
That you have, yes. We're both bald. That's thus the elder and younger baldies.
But you can easily tell the difference between us by the color of our beards.
Yes, very much so.
His, I have a gray beard, white, almost white, and yes. His is kind of black.
Right. So between the two of us, it's easy to understand. I'm also wearing a hat because it's cold in here and he is not. So you should be able to tell us apart easily in all future conversations. Yes.
Right. Exactly. All right. That's good. Right. Now we've got that out of the way. We probably ought to do the disclosures.
That was a disclosure. We are
bald.
We are bald. That's the first disclosure. It's important to know we are bald, bearded men, and you might have better use of your time on a Saturday morning or whenever you're listening than to be listening to two bald, bearded men. There. The first disclosure is out of the way.
We think it's important.
True. True.
I'm listening to one. Well, actually, I guess I'm listening to myself too. So I am listening to two bald, bearded men on a Saturday morning. If you can say that quickly five times, you're not drunk.
You hope.
Right. So let's talk about disclosures.
Yes. This is The Personal Wealth Coach. It is not just a radio program or a podcast. It's also the name of an SEC registered investment advisory firm. We have to tell you that because the SEC wants us to. Mm-hmm. Just because we're registered with the SEC as a firm doesn't mean that the SEC likes us in any way. There's no implication of liking. That's a government agency and they don't do that. So there's no approval or liking, even if we seek it. Approval seeking doesn't really work with the SEC. Okay, so that's out of the way. Second is that I just said that we were registered and doing business as fiduciaries giving investment advice, and we're on the radio, and we can't do fiduciary investment advice on the radio because it means we would have to know all of you, and we would have to have some form of private channel of communication to each of you that none of the others could hear while we were doing this. Sounds like telepathy to me. Do you think we could do that?
I think it is theoretically possible, but improbable.
Improbable at this point. Okay, so that being said, we can't give you direct investment advice on the air. Instead, we're going to be giving educational information. We're hopefully going to fill your brain with knowledge, or at least try.
I can give some investment advice.
Go ahead.
Buy low, sell high. If you buy an investment that you want to go up and it doesn't go up, don't buy it in the first place.
Yes.
If it does go up, sell it. If it goes higher, go buy a beer.
A beer?
After you sell it and it goes up anyway.
What
makes you?
Why? What if I don't want a beer?
Well, you stimulate the economy when you buy the beer. You can just keep the can on the shelf or something.
Aha. I suppose that is reasonable. Okay.
Right.
So that being said, the next disclosure after beer buying would be, you want to deem to tell us what the next one is?
Well, the information we present on this educational radio program, since we're not giving advice, it's educational, has been obtained from sources we deem to be reliable, but we make no warranty or guarantee as to the accuracy or completeness of said information.
And especially make no guarantee or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of unsaid information.
Actually, I can make a guarantee. Anything that's unsaid is incomplete.
Unless its completeness was its lack of saying.
We could go on like that all day.
Yeah, we could. This is a very deep philosophical conversation, but instead we're going to move on to the next disclosure, which is we don't
that. You got it. You go ahead.
Yes.
You
do it. We don't pay for this radio program, nor are we paid to do the radio program. However, we do pay for advertisement for the radio program, as does the studio. So there's a partnership in promoting this, but we're not paid to do it, nor do we pay to do it. And that is the last of our disclosures, I believe. And now we're going to disclose the events of the market over the past week.
The market. By market, we mean the stock, bond, some of the stock, bond, and other markets and commodity just a little bit. The S&P 500 stock index is the one we use to track what the market is doing because, very frankly, sometimes the Dow goes a different direction. It's only got 30 stocks in it, and sometimes it goes a different direction than the broad market, so we use the S&P 500 stock index. It ended the week at 4488.28. That's another one you can remember. I told people to remember 4,500 because it was a nice round figure, but 4488, that's one I can remember.
How about any of the other ones, like the 4143 number? Too hard to remember? Okay.
4444, double it, and you get 88.
Okay.
I'll remember this as kind of a benchmark. It's down 1.27% for the week, and that tells you something. And this is the peculiarity of this market we're in right now. The market is up 6.75% for the last month. It's down 5.83% year to date, and it's up 8.71% from this time last year. So the market is down and up and down and up. You like that?
Right. You could say that any week.
Well, no, actually, for the last year or so,
we've had a lot of up.
I could say that the market was up for the week. It was up for the trailing month. It was up year to date, and it was up from a year ago. I mean, it's been doing that for some time, and we kind of got used to it. But we're in a market now that if it's whether you perceive it as up or down depends on how far back you're looking, and at different time intervals over the last year, it was either up or down. Now, if you go out 3 years or 5 years or 10 years, it's up. But it's kind of doing an up and down sort of thing. The CRSP Mid-Cap Value Index, which is another index we track because we like mid-cap value, it actually dropped 0.48% for the week. It's sitting at 2584.14, leaving it down 0.51% for the week. It's down 0.51 for 2022 so far this year. It's up 4.77% for the last month and up 8.94% from this time last year. So that part of the market is up and down and up and down and up and down. If that's confusing, it is confusing. The market is in what is commonly referred to, at least in the media, as a slog.
A slog.
It goes, and bull markets tend to go through this, by the way. This is a very classic bull market behavior of going for after a big rise, going through a period of time where it's up and down and up and down and up and down. Very characteristic. So is the market up or down? Yes. But for a long-term investor, it's up. So that's what counts. There's a couple of things that are really, positive out there right now. We reported this in the newsletter, Morningstar does a really good job of analyzing quantitative information. It's called quantitative analysis, logically enough. And they determine whether any given stock is above or below fair market value and publish it if you pay it for them for the publication. And they say it's at a slight discount, which is a good thing, which means the market is probably based on earnings and interest rates and all the other stuff that typically affects the long-term return of the stock market at a slight discount. Markets tend to get way ahead of themselves before major falls. So, we're actually in pretty good shape in the market. And the other thing we like, and this is backwards, but this is the way it works. There is an abundance of pessimism out there. Everything I read, almost without exception, says a recession is coming. It's a bear market. It's a bad time. And then I read the comments on the articles in the Wall Street Journal and other places. And again, it's get out. It's going to be terrible. The bottom is going to fall out. That is really a good sign because this is old Baldy here. I remember very clearly the bear market of 1973-74, which is back when Hammurabi was making his code in Babylon or something. And I remember all the bear markets since. And I can tell you without exception, major bear markets are preceded by excessive unrestrained optimism, or as Alan Greenspan is so famous for saying, irrational exuberance. So the other thing, let's go to the next market, the 10-year treasury note.
Just to give accreditation where it's due, Alan Greenspan made it more famous than it already was, but irrational exuberance was coined by Professor Shiller.
Indeed. He, matter of fact, he wrote a book by that name.
Right. And so he was, his book cover was being quoted there. We often attribute Greenspan because he's the one that really boosted that book by saying that. But,
well, as I said, as Alan Greenspan so famously said.
Right.
See, I didn't. Yeah. Okay.
I just needed to quibble.
More disclosure. Quibble.
Quibble. Yes. I'm a quibbler.
Right. But not Kibler. Yes. No. The U.S. 10-year Treasury note. And this is where, if you follow the financial news media and the pundits and the commentators and et cetera, they're talking about the bond market a lot. Much of what they're saying doesn't make a lot of sense, but it's pretty sensational.
They don't know it doesn't make sense, and most of the readers don't know it doesn't make sense. They just know it sounds very intellectual.
Right. And for most people, when I talk about the bond market, they have this blank look in their eyes that turns into glassy look because, as one said, as one person that I talked to about it recently said, there's a bond market. And in a sense, there's not. There's no New York Bond Exchange.
There's not a big exchange for them, that's for sure.
There's no NASDAQ Bond Exchange. It's an informal market, and it's really much harder to track. The benchmark for that market is the U.S. 10-year Treasury note yield. It climbed 14% this week to 2.712%. Now, put that in perspective. A year and a quarter ago, it was 0.91%. It's now 2.712%. That's huge. It's up. Matter of fact, it's up 80% so far this year in one quarter.
As far as the yield, it's not so good on principal.
Oh, man. The principal... matter of fact, I was just looking at a bond fund in the last 6 months has lost 12%. If you just had your money in the bond fund and you saw your value of 6 months ago and you looked at it yesterday, you would have noticed that your value has declined 12% while the stock market has gone up. This is something that I think is shocking a lot of people. It's a subject of a whole deep consideration when we consider portfolios. For example, historically, a safe, relatively conservative portfolio had 60% stocks, 40% bonds. Whoa. Right now, if you look at the potential return of that portfolio, it is terrible. And largely because if you've got 40% of your investment in something that has lost that much money and shows every sign of losing money into the future, it's going to be rough. Anyway, that's a whole show. We could talk about that. The good news is that if you look carefully at the interest rates along the yield curve, which you have to kind of hunt up and figure out, the difference between the 2-year and 10-year notes is positive. The 2-year Treasury note is yielding 2.52%, and I just said we got 2.7 at 10 years. Now, why is that important? There are two Treasury sets of maturities that tend to be indicative of a future recession coming if they go upside down. By upside down, I mean if the longer maturing treasury has a lower interest rate than the shorter maturing treasury, then the interest rates are upside down.
Now, go ahead. Then just as a quick explanation for that, because as soon as you start talking interest rate, people lose interest. It's kind of funny. If you think about a mortgage on a house, a 30-year mortgage interest rate is higher than a 15-year mortgage interest rate, because that's typical. When that's backwards, it means that people are afraid to put their money away for longer periods of time. That's not good for the long term, and that's a really quick and easy explanation.
Well, so the 2- and 10-year spread, as it's called, is important. The other one is between 90 days and 18 months, but you really can't find the 18-month yield anywhere easily. So it's the 90-day and 2-year note that's also very positive right now. So if you're following the news media about finances and markets and so on, and they talk about a yield curve inversion. In fact, there is a small inversion in the mid-zone of the yield curve, but it's not inverting where it needs to invert to forecast a recession. Now, it doesn't mean the recession is not coming. It's just that the bond market yield curve is not forecasting a recession at this point. As a matter of fact, the best academic studies say the key is between 90 days and 18 months, and that's extremely positive, which indicates
goodness, we
got quite a ways to go before we're looking at a recession. Now, could that change during the next year? It sure could, because the Fed is pushing up short-term rates. Now let's go to oil. We track West Texas intermediate crude oil, which is a very crude thing to track, because it affects prices in the United States directly. It fell, the price of oil fell 1.63% for the week to $97.86. Now, why is it important? First off, it affects the price of gasoline with a big lag, the lag that can easily last a month, by the way. The other thing is, before the war, before the invasion of Ukraine, economists were widely predicting that as the summer approached, the price of West Texas intermediate crude would go to $100 a barrel.
That was without thinking about whether or not Russia was invading Ukraine.
So it's behaving as expected, which is a good thing. Now, that does that mean that the pump prices are pleasant? No. However, if you go back as recently as 2018, we had prices this high at the pump. We had it in 2008. We had prices this high at the pump, or nearly this high. So this is not as abnormal as you might think it is. So it's not going to sink anybody's battleship. And the diesel is unusually high, and that is going to have an effect.
Yeah, and that has a lot to do with refining capacity. We're shipping a lot of stuff, and that's requiring a lot of diesel, and that capacity is not as high as it should be to make more diesel. So that's important too.
We said this last week, but it's important to note at this point, and this may upset somebody's political feathers, I don't know. United States refineries are running at capacity right now. That's the limiting factor. I've read several articles and several letters and heard people say if the Keystone XL pipeline had been allowed to open, then gasoline prices wouldn't be so high. No.
Not true.
First off, the oil that was going to come through that pipeline is still coming through another pipeline, a lot of it, about 80% of it, and it doesn't give much gasoline. And secondly, they wouldn't be accepting the oil in the refineries on the Gulf Coast at this point because it doesn't give a lot of gasoline or diesel. And right now, the refineries are leaning toward producing gasoline and diesel. And to do that, they need light, sweet gasoline, or at least intermediate, or not gasoline, oil, which, or at least intermediate oil. And that's what they're refining. So if the XL Keystone, the Keystone XL had been completed and was ready to pump oil at this point, it basically wouldn't be, there wouldn't be any oil coming through there because we don't have any place to put it and the refineries don't have any room to refine it. So it's one of those things where the cause and effect isn't what you might think it was. That's just reality of the real markets. The big issues in the market, frankly, that are going to have the most destabilizing effect are the wheat markets and some elements in the metal markets. Ukraine is one of the largest wheat producers in the world. Russia is right behind them, and we're in like number three. It's going to be great for farmers, maybe.
Well, yeah. And just step in here for just a second. Right now, the number one producer of oil on the planet. You got a guess on that?
I would think it'd probably be us.
Yeah. As of January, so this is prior to the invasion, we don't have data yet. It's coming. It's always a little bit late. But we've got data here saying 11 million barrels of oil a day being produced in the United States, as opposed to Russia, which was just behind at 10.5 million, and Saudi Arabia at 10.2 million. Now, we're not exporting as much as Russia and Saudi Arabia did because our populations are much bigger. But that's just a reference right there. The number one producer of oil in the world is the United States right now.
The problem is we're also the number one user of oil. This is amazing. 20 million barrels per day are used in the United States. That's how much oil we burn. China is way behind us at 12.8 million. India is at 4.4. Japan at 4 million barrels a day. One of the reasons I am very convinced that people have said the Chinese GDP is really as big as the United States GDP. They're just measuring it wrong and the Chinese are going to run over. Well, for better or worse, and a lot of people don't like it, use of oil is a really good measure of gross domestic product. We're at 20, Chinese are at 12 or 13 per day, which tells you the relative size of our economies. Anyway, I thought that was important.
I agree with that. So not just the wheat, the oil side, we're not experiencing as big an uptick in prices as other places on the planet because it's right here. We're getting some uptick in prices, but we're producing more than Saudi Arabia, more than Russia, and that was before the war. So good news on that front.
And we're producing more than we're actually making, which I investigated that because people were saying, why, if we're producing so much oil, why are we importing oil? Because we have a booming economy and we're burning more than we're drilling, than we're bringing out of the ground, which means we need to import a bunch of oil every year.
Yeah. So does that wrap up your markets?
Yeah, I could go on about it and rattle on for an extended period of time, but we probably ought to change the subject.
Yeah, and we've got two questions waiting out there from Inquisitor John. Thank you, John. Okay.
John asked us, with recent global events, particularly the pandemic, inflation, and global food impacts, that there will be a paradigm shift from globalization to more nationalism and from just in time to just in case. Yes. Well, yes, with a big caveat.
Yes, plus. Yeah.
There's basically going, I think, this is what I'm seeing happening. There's basically, the world is becoming polarized.
Wait, it already had two poles. Are you saying there's going to be a West Pole and an East Pole now?
Yes, like there used to be.
Oh, okay. So we have a North Pole, a South Pole, an East Pole, and a West Pole. The West Pole is somewhere between Europe and the United States, and the East Pole is somewhere between Russia and China.
Actually, if I were going to place the West Pole, I would place it pretty much somewhere in the United States, because oddly enough, Japan is part of the Western world.
Yeah, it kind of stretches it around.
And so is Taiwan, and Taiwan is a big economy. But there is going to be some changing. We, during the period of globalization and the New World Order after the fall of the Soviet Union, there was a tendency to go truly global, look for low labor costs wherever you could find them, no matter what kind of government the country had, and to try to sell to those same countries. And it was really good for the world economy. It was really good for our economy. That's gone. And when it comes to just in time, yes, I think we're going to go into a period where we are going to take a hard look at anything that's vital to the United States economy and say, how secure is that source of what's vital? China is coming under suspicion. Russia is obviously off the table, but the world, meaning the particularly the developed world, well, actually the whole world, was largely dependent upon everybody who produces oil on a large scale, continuing to produce the oil. And Europe, for example, as many people are aware right now, was very, very, very dependent upon Russian gas. Successive presidents, matter of fact, every president we've had for the last several presidents have warned the Europeans, particularly the Germans, that that's a really bad idea. And one of the things I think a lot of people are unaware of is Chancellor Merkel, who was Chancellor, the boss of, the leader of Germany for many, many years, really believed sincerely that economic cooperation would lead to peace and prosperity for everybody. And there was really no need to have an armed forces, or not much of one, and that by becoming really good customers of Russia, Russia would change its stripes, which is really crazy because Russia is a bear and bears don't have stripes.
It's a striped bear. We're going to mix these metaphors as hard as we can.
And that is now out the window. There is no longer the assumption, obviously, by anybody that I know of, except the Koch brothers, that Russia is a good place to do business. China is still vital to what we do, in the United States and what happens in the world. They just make so much stuff so well that it's a problem. But one of the things I think we have to become aware of, and I think we are becoming aware of, is that to the degree we are dependent for our survival or our viability on China, we're probably making a mistake. And I think, John, you're correct. I think you're going to see, instead of the dependence upon, we order, it'll be here in a certain number of days, so we don't have to have any reserves. We're going to go back across the board to, we need to keep some cushion and some inventory of stuff we need built up, and we need to have it coming from reliable sources. That's just a reality. It's happening in my house. I don't know if it's happening in your house. We have several weeks right now worth of canned and non-perishable food sitting in our utility room. And I don't think we made a conscious decision. I don't think my wife made a conscious decision to do that because of any specific thing going on. But twice we have been through scares now that maybe the food won't be on the shelves in the supermarket. And so there's a tendency when that happens to buy the stuff and set it aside. And of course, then you got to rotate through it so that you don't exceed the shelf life and all that kind of stuff. So John, yep, you're correct. It's less efficient. That's one of the reasons prices are going up. We might as well just get used to the fact that the low prices we have seen are probably a thing of the past, because as soon as you start buying stuff in advance and storing it, it becomes lowers efficiency and raises prices. So John, you're correct. The world has changed. This is one of those moments in time that for the next several decades, high school students and middle school students will read about it in their history book and have to take tests on this stuff, just like we did about the lead up to World War II and things like that. And then they'll promptly forget it until they do it again.
Yeah, that's the way humans work. We remember as long as we can, and then when we can't anymore, we just repeat what we can't remember. It's fantastic.
Yeah. So you probably want to go to the other question. Is there any truth in that?
This is a fantastic question. Thank you for letting me take it. This is Inquisitor John has, as is traditional, taken a picture of the Wall Street Journal with a circle on it saying, I know what article he's talking about, and he circled it in pen, and then he sent it to me digitally, so I can look it up on the digital Wall Street Journal. But in this case, I really don't have to. John, this is a fantastic question. I know I say that a lot, but you've outdone yourself. The question here is there any truth to this? And then the circle is, In this article, it says most of the return of the stock market over time comes from a few high-performing super stocks. More than 95% of all stocks over their lifetime as public companies collectively don't even outperform cash. And more than half deliver negative returns, according to finance professor Hendrik Bessembinder of Arizona State University. He's one of my favorite economists. He wrote a paper back in 2018 that this is based on. And it sounds like what this quote means is the opposite of what this quote means. It sounds like this says more than 95% of stocks don't make any money, don't profit. Because it says more than 95% of all stocks over their lifetime as public companies collectively don't even outperform cash. It's true. This is deeply, deeply true. And it sounds terrifying on the surface because it's defying all of our logic about the stock market being a great innovator. Here's the quote part that you have to recognize in here. Over the lifetime as a public company. Public companies don't last forever. And if it's over their lifetime, that means that they died. If it covers their whole lifetime. And sometimes the end of the company is much more traumatic than what was built up to it. That's what bankruptcy is about. And there's another piece in here. If you don't count dividends, this is true. So what are we talking about here? I actually talked about this paper in 2018 when it was published. It was published in the journal Finance. And I talked about it on the air. I'm going to have to look this up. But basically what I said at the time was this big controversial thing. Warren Buffett is known as a buy and hold investor. And the whole subject that I was talking about multiple years ago, 4 years ago now when this paper was published, was that buy and hold works really, 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 really well for a long time. But there are very few companies that are around for more than about 70 years, which means that if you buy and hold forever, it's almost a sure thing that you'll lose money if you can live for more than 70 years from the time of your purchase. The life cycle of a company doesn't last that long. And we can go through a lot of companies that have gone bankrupt. I mean, General Motors, Enron, Westinghouse, U.S. Leather. Yeah, I mean, the names, even without getting to Lehman Brothers and places like that. every corporation eventually ends. And that's what is being said here, and that the ones that are left, so this paper goes from 1926 to 2016, and he's looking at this, all stocks that registered during that time period, what happened to them? How did they do? And the ones that are left, this is a 90-year period, so the ones that are left are the ones that are called the super stocks. So IBM still exists. It was around as international business machines and made mechanical typewriters and things like that. Well, what do they do now? Well, they do a lot of things. They're not really international business machines anymore. They're just IBM. They're a large company that's doing a lot of stuff. Has it made a profit during the lifetime of the company? Well, pretty much. There've been a few years where it didn't do so well, but it's made a profit the whole time. Most companies fail. General Electric was on the way to failure, just like Westinghouse was, when Jack Welch stepped in and revived it. And then it fell again, and then it got revived again. So you can take a company and revive it. Nokia is working on that right now. They could have disappeared. So the reality is that you can't just say, I will own a company for the rest of my life if you live for 1,000 years. Because that company's not likely to be there. There aren't any companies that are 1,000 years old. I just hate to break that to you, but that's true. No companies are 1,000 years old at this point. Lloyd's of London is several hundred years old, and it's kind of known as being around a long time, but that doesn't mean it couldn't make some really bad decisions and go away tomorrow.
I don't think you can buy shares in it, but the Roman Catholic Church might disagree with you on that.
You are correct. The Roman Catholic Church has been an entity for a long time. I'm not sure that it had ownership in the same sense as a company, though. It is kind of known as a corpus rather than a company, which is... all that being said, this is a fantastic paper, and the part that they're quoting here isn't the best part of it. The part that should be quoted is the reason why he is such a good economist. His concept in the paper was you got to innovate or you're going to die, that you have to continually be innovating in what you do in your life cycle or you turn into these failed companies. And so he's kind of known as the high priest of moonshot investing, speaking of churches and so on. He's the guy that basically said, if you're not spending money on something that can make you revenue in the future, then whatever replaces the technology you have now is going to kill your company. And for that purpose, he's one of my favorite economists on the planet. All right, you look like you want to say something.
Addressing John's question, it's a good idea to read. If you read the whole article, Jason Zweig has some very good things to say, but you need to be careful how you read them. That is a little piece taken from an article warning about the dangers of ESOPs.
Yeah, the employee stock option or purchase plans, these companies that are owned by their own employees.
And there's a lot of positive to employee stock ownership plans. Companies that have them historically have done far better than companies that didn't have them. Their stock has done better. The productivity is better. The retention of employees is better. There's a lot of pluses to it. The danger that Jason Zweig, who I generally agree with, except on rare occasion where I think he's completely in left field, the danger he's pointing out is if you, as an example, let's give an example for those who may or may not remember Enron. The Enron employee stock ownership plan resulted in many of its employees, perhaps a majority of your employees, having their entire retirement plan Enron stock because Enron was basically giving the stock to the employees. And if they put money in, they give them more stock. And that's really wonderful. And the stock kept going up and they got really excited about it. And then it went away. And when it went away, it went completely away, like to zero. Diversification is the argument that he's making. Putting your, if you're going to work for a company for 30 years, and that, by the way, is the, some of the articles suggest that, and you put all your money in the company stock, companies historically don't do well over a 30-year period. Very few companies do really well over a 30-year period. Now, this is a 90-year period that the article he's quoting refers to.
Yeah.
And it's pretty, he's right. Only 5% of the companies survived and did well over a 90-year period. But very few people live long enough to buy and hold. Can I give another example?
Sure.
I know some people whose parents or even grandparents made a great deal of money in a particular class of stock where they worked. And it's a class. And very specifically, it is the energy class, oil. And during the time that their parents were alive, now these people are elderly now, but during the time their parents were alive, the stock in these companies went up phenomenally because they increased the use of oil increased dramatically in the United States for 1,000 reasons. However, even though we've had a recent run-up in prices in oil companies, if you go back 10 or 15 years and you look at the major oil company stock price, you'll find out it has been generally, this is obviously going to change from one company to another, but generally speaking, it has not kept up with inflation. So their decision to continue to hold that company because their father or grandfather bought it and made a lot of money on it, from an emotional point of view, I'm sure it's valid and we support it. From a financial point of view, there's the example. My parents' generation saw oil as the place to make money over the long term.
Plastics, my kid. Plastics.
That has reversed. Now, it went down dramatically and it's come back up to very low long-term return and it's been a sudden shoot up. But I can also tell you, even the oil companies are acknowledging right now that unless they diversify into something else a lot, they're going to be in a world of hurt over the next decade.
A quick example of that, this is kind of moving to a different subject. Now we're talking about oil and oil stocks. We've got clients that have made a lot of money in oil. We use oil in our vehicles. We have power that is made from petroleum products. So you got to hear us as being consumers of oil, not directly. I wouldn't drink it or anything. You get what I'm saying. But oil as a producer of energy has been the most efficient way of doing it for a long, 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 long time. It's got some competition now. And as the technology comes along that gets more efficient in replacing it, this becomes very, very clear. Here's an example. And this is a pretty simple one. Heat pumps. Are you familiar with what these things are?
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a thing to cool. You have one?
We have three of them. No, four of them in our house.
Okay. A heat pump is basically how your refrigerator keeps itself cool. And people discovered at some point, not too long after refrigeration, that, hey, you could also use it to make your things warm. But it wasn't very efficient, especially if it's really cold outside. It's hard to get heat from outside and pipe it inside if it's cold outside. Well, the technology has exponentially increased since then. There are heat pumps around today. Just your standard heat pump of today is more efficient at heating your house, even in places like Chicago, where it's very cold, than burning the gas directly in a furnace in your house. So if you think about that for a second, actually burning the gas is less effective at heating the house than a power plant miles away with a 40% efficiency. That means 60% of the energy is lost to create electricity and pipe it to your house and then use it to heat your house. And yet the heat pump is more efficient, even with those handicaps, than burning the gas directly because the technology has gotten better. It's easier to take the existing heat from around us and move it in without destroying the gas to do it with. Instead, you've got this electricity that kind of gives a feedback loop where you're getting more heat the longer you do it or more cold the longer you do it. That's one technology that's saying more efficient than natural gas, which is more efficient for creating heat than oil. So that's one example, and I know I kind of went off and got detailed on it. One example of thousands of new types of technology that is producing energy quicker and more efficiently than what was available before. So when you come in with other types of energy production, nuclear fusion at some point in the future, hydrogen and other renewable energies, well, oil is not, it's not a monopoly on energy production anymore. And that's going to cause oil long-term to not do as well as it has in the past. That's a pretty normal statement when new technology comes along. And we've got to play some commercials. If you'd like to join the conversation, I don't think we've actually given our email addresses out the whole hour. If you'd like to ask us a question, we have email waiting at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. That's Tango, Papa, Whiskey Charlie, or thepersonalwealthcoach.com. And we will read it. And if it's not horribly vulgar or having to do with some form of professional sport, we'll actually talk about it. Until then, we're going to play some commercials and we'll be back on the other side with more of The Personal Wealth Coach. And we're back with more of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jake and
Jeff
McClure. And would you like to take the next subject?
Man, there's a lot to talk about. And we've only got like 5.5 minutes. And before the next, and then we'll go into the next hour.
We can talk about housing. We can talk about interest rates. We can talk about all kinds of good stuff.
One of the things to get off on a completely different subject is estate planning.
Cool.
And one of the things I think people are unaware of is the law, the rules, the law changed with the Secure Act. That was like in 2017. It was
2018, I think.
Yeah. But the rules are just now coming out and they are confusing and weird. If you inherit an IRA, I'm not even going to try to explain the rules for when you have to take the money and how fast you have to take the money. Get professional help. Don't assume that you're going to be able to grasp it. Suffice to
2019.
Suffice to say that the Secure Act eliminated for most beneficiaries the ability to spread a big IRA's income out over your lifetime. It, by and large, has to be taken within 10 years unless you're a spouse. And then there's some other peculiar rules about people who are within 10 years or outside of 10.
And by beneficiaries, we mean someone died and left you their IRA.
Right. The important thing is the rules are still in flux, by the way. We have a 2019 law. It is getting towards the middle of 2022, and the rules are still flexing.
And the second version of the act is about to be passed, likely, in which case the rules are going to get even more complicated and unknown.
The important thing is if you inherit an IRA and you're not a spouse of the person you're inheriting it from, get professional help immediately. Don't try to do this yourself at home, because not only are the rules already incredibly complicated and the CPAs of the United States and elsewhere are even arguing about how to interpret those rules, they're going to get more complicated. That was just a real short thing. The big thing I want to talk about, and we don't have enough time this hour, we'll talk about it next hour, and I think it's important, is the Fed is raising rates. People are saying in the news media, that's going to cause a recession. A lot of people are saying that. The underlying economy, the leading indicators in the underlying economy, and we can go into this into some detail, are indicating smooth sailing ahead. So we have this conflict between two sets of indicators, if you will, although one of them is kind of speculative, long-term, this always happens, and the other one is, these are the solid indicators, and there's a big conflict in the economy right now. I want to go into that in some detail next hour, but to suffice to say, if you can't stay around, the leading economic indicators, and there's a lot of them, that we can see at this point, all strongly suggest that the market and the economy, I shouldn't say the market, the economy will probably be doing well through this year. Now, the stock market can do anything it wants to, but generally speaking, the stock market reacts to future economic events that it perceives, and it probably will do well too. As a matter of fact, there's plenty of indicators it'll do well. So if the Fed raising interest rates, why the panic? Why are people scared? And I think we need to talk about that a little bit. Yes, when we have high inflation historically and the Fed gets excited and starts doing half point interest rate increases, which they say they're going to do, and they start shrinking their balance sheet, which they say they're going to do, historically, there's a pretty high probability that there's a recession coming. But I can tell you one other thing before we close out the hour. At any given moment, if you've had a bull market and a healthy economy for a couple of years, there's a high probability there's a recession coming. So we need to close out the hour.
Right.
This is the Personal Wealth Coach.
If you would like to talk to us off the air, we actually do that. That's how we make our living. We have voicemail waiting during the weekend and real live people during the week at
254-947-1111, and you will not get a phone tree.
Or 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, where you can sign up for our newsletter. You can read our past newsletters, listen to radio programs going back a long ways. Check and see if we're right. We also have podcasts available wherever podcasts are available. You can also email us directly at Jeff or Jake at tpwc.com. Until next hour, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach.